Lynchowski, Berkeley, tape one, side two. Dr. Lynchowski.
Well, we were just speaking about the Iranian-Saudi relationships and the fact that the Shah was rather unhappy when I made a remark that Saudi Arabia also had a sort of a white revolution and made a deprecating gesture at that time, which led us to further discussion of the Saudi situation and let us remember that Saudi Arabia on a few occasions had some dissent movements, in fact some 15 years ago, and that was about the time when we were talking to the Shah about it. There was an attempt in the Saudi Air Force at some dissent, and many Saudi Air Force officers were arrested. I know about it intimately because one Saudi Air Force officer, a lieutenant colonel, was taking a doctorate under my supervision here in Berkeley, and he was lucky to be in Berkeley because if he were in Saudi Arabia, all sorts of pressures might have landed him in the midst perhaps of this conspiracy or whatever, and he might have suffered. So we were speaking about the situation in Saudi Arabia with the Shah, and when I asked him whether he thinks that Iran and Saudi Arabia should cooperate for the sake of stability, well, he said definitely they should, but he has grave doubts about Saudi stability. It now sounds paradoxical because they have survived and seem to be still well entrenched, but he's no more there.
Dr. Lynchowski, before we move out of this discussion of the Shah and his personality and the way in which he reacted to various phenomena, I would like to ask you this question. He seems, from what you say and from what other people have said, he seems like a man who knew what he was doing, like a man who was intelligent enough to understand his surroundings, and he seems at least to have had the ability to get other people do what he wanted them to do, certainly Iranians, and to some extent one could say this about his relationship with outside non-Iranians, certainly with some of the Westerners and others. Yet in the last year of his reign he seems to have shown a great deal of psychological paralysis, a lack of ability to react, lack of ability to make decisions, at least on the surface this is how it looks. And some people have made a great deal of this. Would you react to this?
Yes, I would say that this kind of psychological paralysis to which you refer, that occurred in the last year of his reign, could be ascribed, as I see it, right away to three factors. One was his own illness, which was a terminal illness, and he was aware of it, but the other people were not. Secondly, there was a shock of these monster demonstrations against him, where the people who were privileged by him, the intelligentsia, the bureaucracy, were marching out in the streets against him, bank employees and so on. That's what you were calling thanatos, suicide on a national scale. I think it must have been a terrible shock to him to realize that so many people are willing to do it, that the girls in the universities who really owed the fact that they were students in the universities to him, to his secularizing policy, to his pro-feminist liberation policy, were now putting scarves or veils to conform with the pressures of the Islamic leaders. That must have been a terrible shock. He has never experienced demonstrations on this big scale, unless these were the Tuda demonstrations before under the Soviet aegis, but this came from inside Iran. And the third was the mixed signals from Washington. Certainly, they were mixed, there is no doubt, there is plenty of documentation on this. Ex-President Carter's own book, Brzezinski's book, Vance's book, the book by Michael Ledeen and William Lewis on the American debacle in Iran and so on, or Rubin's book on Paved with Good Intentions. the signals were very mixed because the Carter administration concentrated, made human rights a central point of its foreign policy. To be sure, not unanimously. Brzezinski certainly was not of this opinion, but the others were, while at the same time he was calling the Shah his best ally. And so when we read the record of American-Iranian relations during the Carter administration, it's a dismal record of very mixed signals. And no doubt that even a person not as sick as the Shah was already at that time could be confused.
On the other hand, there were people at the time, and certainly this has an even longer background, who talked of the Shah or called him all kinds of names, a very ferocious leader, so to speak, someone who would easily, presumably, resort to killing people in order to remain in power or to get his own way. Again, I'd like to have your reaction to it in terms of your personal contact with it. Did he ever look to you as someone who was capable of doing this, or did you ever get the feeling that this man was able, in effect, to do this kind of thing?
Well, I know from the record that the Shah, at one time or another, was willing to resort to massive violence, particularly in 1962 during the first agitation of Khomeini. But at that time he acted under the advice, very decisive advice, of Asadollah Alam, who convinced him that he should not hesitate to use force. And he was probably right, because the Shah used force and prevailed. Unfortunately, he did not have this type of decisive advice in 1978. And of course, perhaps in 1978, precisely because of these mixed signals from Washington, to which we referred previously, he would hesitate to do this. There was undoubtedly some change in his attitudes, but in the private conversations with him, I never felt that he was a recklessly cruel man. I am pretty sure that his father would have reacted with brutality against this kind of thing. I think that he was already a little too, shall I say, civilized, too mollified by his Western experiences, by living in Switzerland, by knowing what democracy was about, to say to himself, all right, I'll go and shoot the people to the left and to the right. This, by the way, might lead me to another remark here in my reminiscences, namely that when Amini was prime minister in the early 60s, and he was an old friend of mine still from wartime, when I was press attaché, I already knew him, I lived in his mother's house, as a matter of fact, in Park Fahr el-Dowleh. So I knew him and I had an easy access to Amini. I must say that the Shah appointed Amini reluctantly as prime minister. Amini was the last prime minister that I knew who would say, I have got the power now and people are polite to me. No other prime minister would say that to me. Iqbal would not say that, Alam would not say this, but Amini did. So at that time I had one or two conversations with the Shah. And at the beginning of one of the conversations, I said to the Shah, well, Your Majesty, you have a prime minister who has shown a good deal of courage. And the Shah asked me, perhaps with a tone of annoyance, and in which way? I said, well, he placed a number of generals under arrest for corruption. That does require some courage. And the Shah answered very decisively, he did not place the generals under arrest. The commander-in-chief places the generals under arrest, and I am the commander-in-chief. And so he tried to deprive Amini of, in a way, of the privilege of making this decision. And then I mentioned a few other merits of Amini in terms of settling the business with the oil companies and other things, and the Shah was obviously somewhat reluctant to hear this. This was just another example of a slight difference of views that emerged in our conversation with the Shah. I was never aggressive, but I tentatively would say those things, and I would immediately sense when the Shah did not like what I was saying. And again, I have a feeling that no American ambassador could have said these things to the Shah. That was my special privilege as a private person. And now there was another example when I had this sort of a potential disagreement with the Shah. And this was during the elections or electoral campaign in 1962 or 63, because there were two following each other, as you know. And during one of these campaigns, during which, by the way, Asadullah Alam, as Minister of Interior, was, I think, conducting quite a vigorous campaign to have the government prevail, there were elements of opposition, and I asked the Shah, "Your Majesty, we have this electoral campaign. Will you allow the opposition to be represented in the parliament?" Well, he said, "Oh, sure, we have the Melyun and the Mardom party." Right. Well, I said, "Your Majesty, I know very well that both parties are loyal parties to you, and that the Mardom party is not really a real opposition. The real opposition is represented by other people." He said, "For example, like Mozaffar Bagraei." And I said, "Precisely, Bagraei, Maliki, certain other people, National Front people." He said, "Oh, I see you know the situation in Iran very well." Mm-hmm. Well, I said, "Thank you, Your Majesty, but that's about that kind of opposition that I'm speaking." And he said to me with a degree of annoyance, "Professor Lentrovsky, why do you want to impose the American type of democracy upon Iran?" I said, "Your Majesty, I'm not such a starry-eyed idealist as to try to impose the American system upon Iran. But I'm asking these questions only out of my genuine interest in Iranian stability, in Iranian security, and in your own welfare as ruler of this country. So please understand that this is my motivation." Well, he said, "All right, I'll explain it to you. Why does not," he said, "Bagraei come to me and asks me to do certain things? He, instead of coming to me, he is agitating out in Kerman or other places, going out to the streets." Well, then he said, "And look at these people in the National Front, some of the earlier allies or associates in the National Front. These people, and you know there were Al-Ahyar Saleh and others, they said," he said, "you know, they were drinking the health of Peshawari during the Azerbaijan crisis. How I can trust those people?" I said, "Well, I understand, Your Majesty, their past may be dubious, and I understand that you don't trust them. The point is, do you prefer them to voice openly their grievances in the parliament if they are elected, if you permit them to be elected, or to go and agitate in the streets and repeat the Mossadegh era?" And he said, "Now look, if they come to the parliament, there may be very few of them, perhaps four or five, but you remember," he said, "what happened during the Mossadegh era. The original National Front was composed of 5, 6, or 7 deputies in the parliament, and you know what they brought about, the oil crisis, because they could agitate in such a way in the parliament as to suborn it and subdue it. And that's why I am critical of their possibility of being in the parliament." Well, I said, "Yes, I understand. That is, in other words, a choice of giving them an opportunity to agitate in the parliament or go out into the streets." And he said, look, I will ask you three questions. First of all, if they are admitted to the parliament, you know what they will do. First of all, they will raise the question of the Iranian-Soviet-American relations and try to reverse the course that we have taken. In other words, the question even of Azerbaijan may be reopened. The question of the whole relationship of Iran to the United States as a friendly cooperation. They will ask for complete neutrality, for a balance between Russia and the United States. Do you as an American want this to happen? Well, I said, no, Your Majesty. Then the next, he said, they will try to reopen the oil question that after the years of travail, 3 years between 51 and 54, we finally managed to resolve. Now they will reopen this question and open a new Pandora's box for oil troubles. Do you want this to happen? I said, no, I don't. Then he said, and the third, they will question the whole political system in Iran as it exists. Do you want this to happen, you as an American? And I said, no, I don't. But then you have given me the answers.
That's very interesting. That's truly interesting. Do you think that this was a strategy with which he fended off, so to speak, Western pressure on him to move towards a more, perhaps, liberal system?
Probably. I think that he believed it, what he was saying, but it was not, that it was not merely tactics, or even if you call it strategy. I think that he genuinely was afraid that if he gives too much of a freedom to these people to voice all of these fundamental objections to Iranian policy and orientation, he will land in big trouble. That he was willing to risk the street agitation, hoping that he will manage it somehow with Savak or whatever other means, rather than bring a decisive group, loud-mouthed like this, whom he would suspect of being possibly some of them in the Soviet pay, to constitute a disturbing element in the Iranian matrix.
Before we move out of this, let me ask another question. The Iranians very often said that if you want to get the Shah, do something, you've got to get some non-Iranian, Westerner, European, and certainly an American, to talk to him about those matters. If the Iranians themselves talk to him about this, this genre of opinion suggests that he probably would not listen, even if there was some merit in it. And even if he assumed that there was some merit in it. But if an American said the same thing, a foreigner said the same thing, he would react to it more favorably. Is this your understanding also? Is this, do you think that this sort of thing
makes
sense?
Well, I had never thought about it exactly in the categories in which you put it. But now, as I think to respond to your question, I would say that there might be perhaps some justification for this point of view. And this is not because the Shah felt slavish towards any foreigner, but simply because of his authoritarian position. He did not expect his own Iranians, to tell him their true feelings. And if they did, you see, he might be annoyed. In other words, I think that there was a combination. He in a way distrusted the Iranians as regards their advice, because either the advice may be too critical for him to accept, or otherwise it would be too obsequious, and so he would not know exactly. While a foreigner, particularly in a more independent position, not connected with any formal instructions of the government, or perhaps, well, a man who was heading the government, like Prime Minister of Britain or President of the United States, etc., if they wish, they might have told him certain things. I think that he would take them into account. But I think the conversations with independent foreigners might have been acting as a kind of a general corrective on his thinking. They would reveal certain aspects of relationship of Iran and his relationship to other forces, whether inside the country or outside of the country, with which the conversations with the Iranians themselves would not necessarily produce. I know one thing, that as regards the careers of certain Iranians, I was in a way probably a bit very partially and perhaps very indirectly and remotely instrumental here and there by saying some good word about particularly my former students, my friends in Iran. And I think that under those circumstances the Shah would probably register in his mind, because even once I had an evidence that we were speaking about someone, and in the next conversation the same name popped up and the Shah remembered.
If we may now move to the other personalities in Iran with whom you've come into contact, certainly those people who became prime ministers and ministers in the government, high positions in the government. Obviously you've met and you've seen, you've talked to quite a number of people who were in these positions. Is there anyone, before we go and take them one by one, but is there any one of them that stands out particularly in your mind, you consider to be perhaps different from...
Well, I would range them this way. Mossadegh certainly stands out, but he stands out as a maverick. Some people may call him fanatic, irrational, or whatever. He probably was irrational. I would even call him slightly senile, perhaps. But I had a lengthy interview with him from which I derived very little, because I asked a number of searching questions and he answered not a single one of them. He engaged in a long monologue in which he repeated all of his political slogans against Britain, against this and that, against the oil company, slogans that I already knew by heart, a student of international affairs and observers of the oil, observer of oil crisis. And it was an utterly disappointing thing. But the one thing that stood about him is that the man was absolutely dedicated to his cause and felt completely independent of the Shah. So in this sense only, I rate Mossadegh low on the scale of statesmanship, the true interests of Iran, but he stands out certainly.
This conversation that you were referring to, this occurred when he was Prime Minister?
When he was Prime Minister.
He was Prime Minister.
I saw him in 1953, in the late spring of 1953, and had a lengthy conversation. He treated me very courteously, but it was, as an interview, it was utterly disappointing. I could have played the same record perhaps even more eloquently than he did, because I knew all of these things by heart. Now, another person who stands up in my is Amini, because Amini was, in my opinion, the last Prime Minister who was loyal to the Shah, but who was independent, who had a mind of his own, as I pointed out previously, or perhaps, I don't know what I said that, but he mentioned to me that now when I have the power, I can do certain things and people are polite to me and so on and so forth. He definitely had certain ideas what to do with the Iranian situation then in the early 1960s. I would say that the person who was perhaps ostensibly the most loyal to the Shah, at least in terms of his words, was Manoucher Iqbal, whom I knew for a long time as a president of the university, as Prime Minister and Minister of the Court, and to whom I owe many audiences with the Shah, who was arranging this. One audience he arranged at two hours' notice. He was extremely cooperative in this sense. But you never could get out of him an independent judgment. Everything that he would say, he would say, I'm fulfilling His Majesty's orders. And according to His Majesty's orders, it's so and so. So there was not a trace or even an attempt to present himself as an independent operator. I would say Hossein Allah always impressed me as a man of great wisdom and certain independence of judgment. Although extremely loyal to the Shah, in the long run one of the most loyal, because it was a loyalty combined with the willingness to express some of his views and criticism to the Shah. He was a gentleman of the old school, and I had a very genuine respect for him. Now, Asadollah Alam was a very intelligent man. He was a real, I would say, kind of courtier of Machiavelli type, almost, you know. And I think he was very loyal. He was personally, he really loved the Shah. At the same time, he was a man of his own independent judgment. That is, he would not conduct an independent policy the way Amini might, but he had his judgment, and I know from certain conversations that I had with him when I happened to be in a group of a few people where a few scholars were present there, and when these scholars were expressing views very obsequious to the Shah, and I expressed a somewhat independent point of view on certain aspects of cultural cooperation between the United States and Iran, Alam took my side and very definitely has shown a certain independence of judgment.
These are American scholars you're talking about?
Were not American scholars. I was the only
American. You were the only American.
I was the only American, and he took my side.
Uh-huh.
As regards Jamshid, I would say this, a man of very high intelligence, very patriotic, but primarily a technocrat, not very political.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to do that.
Yamani and the king opposed it, and I was of the same opinion, by the way. We fully shared it with Yamani. I said, you have made great mistake in OPEC in raising the prices, because it annuls your political policy as regards Arab, Israeli and American relations. And Yamani said to me, yes, you are right, because this was one great disservice rendered to the Arab cause to raise these oil prices. But the Shah was not an Arab, he was not concerned with this. He was interested in developing the country, and there was this mania of engaging in these rapid 5-year plans of building the great civilization.
Yes.
That is where the Shah became, and seems to be, a prisoner of his own words and slogans.
Let me ask you something. Of course, you know, when you're referring to the Arab oil policy and politics in this respect, Israel becomes a very important factor as the whole thing is directed and somehow controlled. Israel, in fact, mobilized other forces and so on forces against the Arabs. Now, the Shah and the Iranian government, the Shah particularly, was also very conscious of Israeli position, Israeli relations with the Arabs, Iran-Israeli relations, and Israel as an ally of the United States, in particular in the area. Did you have any occasion to talk students exchange opinion with respect to Israel?
Yes, I did, but always on a somewhat reduced scale, because I did not want this subject, which always constitutes a major point of conversations with the Arab politicians, to preempt my conversation with the Shah. There was a limited time always, but it did pop up a number of times, particularly since the 1967, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Sinai, etc. Now, the Shah conducted a policy of maintaining a modicum of relationship with Israel without any fanfare of an embassy or so, because oriented well as he was in American politics, he realized the power of the Zionist lobby in the United States. And as a matter of fact, you know, Mrs. Javits, whose husband was a very influential senator, after all, was a sort of a consultant or so, was receiving some stipend from the Iranian government. So I think there was a very realistic appreciation in the mind of the Shah of the role that the friends of Israel are playing here in American legislature, in American media, and in public opinion, in the universities, and so on. At the same time, he was of the opinion that Israel should not be permitted to ride roughshod over the Arabs and occupy their territory without ever returning. So he expressed it clearly to me that Israel should withdraw from the West Bank and that the United States should be putting as much pressure as is politically feasible on Israel to cause it to withdraw. His reasoning was that if we condone this acquisition of territory by force, what will happen next when the Soviets occupy this or other territory? We have to set an example that this is not permissible.
Did he emphasize this sort of thing from early on, or it was the latter years of his
life? I would say it was particularly in the since 1967, that is since the Arab-Israeli war, and perhaps this thing again reappeared after 73, although there was perhaps a little less talk about it since 73, because it led eventually to Camp David, and the Shah was then preoccupied with other things. But certainly, so long as there were cases of violence in the West Bank, or war of attrition between Egypt and Iran in Sinai, the Shah was of the opinion that the Israelis should withdraw.
I suppose this is telling of the Iranian situation. You only see the time because we're talking about the prime ministers and others, and then came back to the top. But something I've jotted down here that's interesting, perhaps I missed it. You talked about a number of prime ministers in Iran, and interestingly enough, you didn't mention Hoveidar, who was the prime minister, obviously, for the longest time in other periods. Is there a significance to that?
Simply because, I don't know why, maybe because Hoveidar did not strike me as an outstanding personality. Maybe he was very clever, but that does not mean that he was very wise. I make a difference between these words. To me, Hussein Ala was a wise gentleman of the old school. Hoveidar, I think, was clever. He was a skillful courtier. He was saying things to the Shah that would please the Shah. But I think the role of the Prime Minister is to be a little more than that. Is to protect the sovereign precisely by sometimes saying the things that the sovereign may not like, to bring him down to earth from some illusions, to prevent him from becoming a prisoner of his own world or slogan. Now, my personal relationship to Hoveidar dates to the year 1945, imagine. In fact, when it was the first time when I visited him as a professor, and he was Minister of Finance, that was sometime in the 1960s or whatever, or early 70s or whatever. No, he was 1960s, yes, because he was 12 years. he was, it was an extraordinary development, because Hobeida said to me, I was introducing myself to him, and he said, Professor Lenchowski, you probably don't remember me, but I was middle official in the Ministry of Finance when you were still a diplomat in the Polish embassy, and I remember you from that time. It was an interesting admission from a high dignitary to say that he was ever middle official. Well, he had certainly the human features, but to me, I never felt that I gained anything truly valuable in terms of discussing political problems with him. He was too bland. Everything was always fine. There were no problems. Or if I asked him during one conversation, because I would pay him during these visits, of course I would visit the Shah. I had much more satisfaction from my conversation with the Shah than with Hobeida. I would come and pay him my first visit on next day on my arrival in Tehran. Mm. And I would say, I would ask him, well, Mr. Prime Minister, what would you describe today as the main problem of Iran? And he would give some sort, he would say, manpower. We need more skilled manpower. Sure, we knew that. They were bringing Pakistani and Indian doctors and nurses and so on. But that was not the kind of talk that I really would expect from my conversation with the Prime Minister. You know, I really never had a very satisfactory conversation with him. It was all great courtesy, you know, many personal courtesies. My wife and I lost luggage once on our way from Jeddah to Tehran, so he immediately mobilized the